Welcome, everyone. My name is Tim Mikelashvili. The possibility of innovation is the driving force behind All Out Coach podcast, as you know. From one conversation to the next, the language that we use operates on cycles, on thresholds, and on colorful spectra rather than strict categories and boxes. In order to constantly update the formulas that are able to translate abstract concepts into exact sciences that we can feel, that we can touch and replicate in our life and our career. I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite a long time because I'm a huge fan and supporter of my guest, Dave Knox, who has mastered his formula to foresight and analysis in business. And he has created powerful observations that have allowed many businesses to grow, scale, and thrive across the different industries. He's going to talk about foresight in business and analysis on this podcast. And he started his career as a digital voice and advocate at Procter & Gamble for 7 years, after which he became a chief marketing officer at Rockfish, which was widely recognized globally as one of the leading marketing agencies. He had a chance to work and consult many Fortune 500 companies, and he bridges the businesses that are widely renowned across the globe with the digital innovation. He speaks globally, TEDx, and he's been invited to some of the most well-known global digital conferences. He has a podcast that he hosts as well called Predicting the Turn. And he's also the best-selling author of the book with that title, Predicting the Turn, which is what really captured my attention and why I reached out to him in the first place, because it truly inspired me. I covered it on All Out Coach, and I'm excited to have you, Dave, join me from Cincinnati. How are you today?
Hey, thanks for having me, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here. And looking forward to it.
Sure. I have a colleague from Procter & Gamble who's been a mentor and a huge, huge influence on my career and in my life. Spent 32 years at Procter & Gamble. And so I've learned just how much the organization did to develop people over the years. He's been a past guest of mine here, Dave. What I'd like to ask you is how you started to develop that instinct for observations and for innovation early on throughout your career. How you've evolved that skill and that talent over the years.
Yeah, one of the best things about P&G is the training that they get for you. When you join, especially in brand management, you're almost spending as much time in training and learning and looking at frameworks and other models as you are at times running the business. A lot of people say it's kind of like a second MBA that you end up getting during those years. Mm-hmm. And for me, one of the things that came up quite often was in the brand building framework, it's, they talk about the who, what, the how, but one of the things you start with is called assess the landscape. And, when I kind of engaged in early in my career, I found that assessing period something that I really enjoyed. The looking out, what is coming, what is taking place, and what changes might be coming as a result of that. And that's something I just kind of really sparked to. And it felt nicely with the period I was kind of in, because for me, I was an undergraduate coming into P&G at, 22 years old. And a lot of my peers I worked with were MBAs from these amazing schools. And, for me, I needed to figure out how I would differentiate myself. And at that time in the early 2000s, digital was that thing that I could kind of differentiate myself with, because a lot of them had experienced the downside during the dot-com days. And for me, I had nothing to lose being the age I was. So that's what kind of led me to start looking at that, assess the landscape, start thinking about digital. And by nature, that meant being external, by looking at what companies were out there changing, thinking differently, mm-hmm. and what could I learn from it.
Were you always an entrepreneur at heart?
What I always say is I was always entrepreneurial at heart, but I've only become an entrepreneur in recent years. And I make that distinction because, for me, the word entrepreneur has a lot of meaning. That's somebody that is risking it on all one pitch and toss. you know, has to really dive in a full way. Mm-hmm. And for me, I've always been entrepreneurial. I'm always thinking about new ways, new challenges, new things. But P&G paid me a very good salary. Rockfish paid me a very good salary. You know, I was not an entrepreneur at those times, despite thinking entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. But it's only since, you know, 2017, when I left the, you know, Rockfish post acquisition, that I could really say I was an entrepreneur, where, you know, I was eating what I killed, you know, as the coaching advising work, you know, other things I was doing, that was being an entrepreneur, not just being entrepreneurial.
Yeah. Just so the listeners also know, and those who are going to watch as well on the YouTube channel, you created Brandery, right? Which was a great, very unique name that I think crosses the lines and the borders between industries. It's almost the place that you would want to go and have a great meeting, or even drink a beer, or just meet with your friends, right? And colleagues. And that, I know that Brandery allowed 85 startups to attract the attention of many venture capitalists and to grow across their life cycles. Can you share some of the highlights from those years, from that experience, from, you know, how you came about building Brandery and what you learned from it?
So the Brandery was born in late 2009. Myself and a few colleagues, we were seeing the change that was taking place with the startup landscape. And one of them, a guy named JB Kropp, had spent a lot of time in San Francisco. I was spending a lot of time in my role at P&G, you know, in Boulder, Colorado, and New York, and others. And it was one of the meetings I had with Dave Cohen, who at the time had just started Techstars. They'd just run, I think, their first, maybe second class. And Cohen made a comment where he said, you know, I really believe that every city has a right to have an accelerator, but those accelerators need to be standing on the shoulders of the giants that built that city. And so when we looked, you know, it would have been easy to say, well, let's go start a tech-based accelerator that's always going to be about SaaS startups or anything else. Instead, you know, JB, Rob, myself, we looked around and said, you know, what's this city known for? And Cincinnati is the town of brands, you know, not just with P&G, but, you know, with Kroger and Cal and Perfetti and all, you know, go down the list. We're a town of brands. And what we looked at is we said, you know, brands are something that's misunderstood, that brands are a lot more than the color and the logo. It's mm-hmm. what you do to build that brand. And we thought the same skill set that it took to build a brand could go into and be applied for a unique way on the startup landscape. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of our inspiration. The other inspiration that we had, though, was we weren't going to be doing it for our own personal financial interests, if you will. So we actually built the Brandery as a nonprofit. So unlike a lot of accelerators out there, the equity that we owned in every startup that went through the program was actually owned by a nonprofit called Main Street Ventures. And our goal was always that we kind of said, if you're going to be teaching entrepreneurs how to be entrepreneurs, we probably need to be entrepreneurial ourselves. And a nonprofit that only survives based on the sponsorship dollars you find every year, that's probably not being very entrepreneurial. So from day one, we created this model that we wanted to be a flywheel and a self-sustaining kind of entity based on the companies we worked with. So that was kind of our inspiration going in. You know, over, call it 2010 through about 2016, you know, we supported those 85 companies that you mentioned. They went on to raise a lot of venture capital, but we had some great companies that were outcomes. So we had companies like Ahology, which ended up purchased by Quotient. And they were one of the really leading players in the whole space of Pinterest marketing and shopper marketing. We had a company called Road Trippers that when they applied, the husband and wife founders were living down in Savannah, Georgia. And they had this idea of, you know, there was so much content and information out there about the great parts of traveling by road, but most of the things out there are about planning a trip that goes as fast as possible instead of enjoying your time on the journey. And how could you find those cool restaurants, those funny landmarks, those just experiences for the road? Mm-hmm. And that was their idea. And they ended up being part of a roll-up that created this amazing new company that's actually headquartered here in Cincinnati as a result. And then we had guys that were shooting for the moon, a company called Flight Car that ended up raising almost $100 million from Andreessen Horowitz and other top VCs. Mm-hmm. That ultimately the company never hit escape velocity, but that's what happens sometimes in startups. You swing for the moon and sometimes it doesn't work all the ways, but
yeah,
it was awesome. And the end result was we were able to create an endowment that today is funding that next generation of entrepreneurs with grants here in Cincinnati to keep the businesses going.
Yeah, I started my career in large companies, global pharma companies, until working my way towards more startups. I feel that startups are different in the velocity of their decision making, and that's really the attraction for many people. Everyone you talk to is interested or inspired by startups and learns from them. And there's one quote I'll mention from Gary Hamel, a management consultant, who says that the groundbreaking ideas happen during the gap between resources and aspirations.
Yeah.
So that leads me to the question of that evolution or that transition from a small company, for example, that's in Series A funding to going to Series B, right? At what point do you stop making those observations and do you actually start implementing new ideas? What has worked? Can you give us some insights?
Yeah. So I think it's a combination. Mm-hmm. So I have this principle and concept that I call continuous beta. And, mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer that you should always be changing, evolving, and growing. So you need to always be doing that. And whether you're a company or a person, you need to be always doing that across the board. And applying that back to a company, I kind of think of your seed funding stage as we have an idea, is there something there? And that's the time to prove out and figure out if something is there. Once you get to Series A, that is when we're going to start taking that thing we prove that it's there, and there's something there to do with it. And now it's the time to start scaling and focusing. But you can never be forgetting the continuous beta at the same time. You have to focus, you have to go after it. But if you're not thinking about those ideas along the way, you never know what you might discover at the same token. So, there's a innovation matrix I had in the book that's old off of Monitor, and it talks about core innovation, adjacent innovation, and transformational innovation. One of the things they found with it is you need to be devoting 70% of your resources on the core. And doing that is, I think of that as the scaling up stage as well. That startup when in that Series A, 70% needs to be on that scaling. But you can't forget the 20 and the 10, which is the adjacent and then the transformational. Because if you're not doing those things, you're just setting yourself up for the next guy to knock you off and to beat you in 2 years or 3 years. So you have to be scaling. But I don't think you can be forgetting about the future and the continuous beta at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So what is that formula to innovation that has led to companies that have just grown and that have taken out other companies completely out of competition in this business world that is so brutal, as you mentioned in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly that. It's focus on scaling while focusing on also what might be around the corner. You take Uber as an example. They've got many, many faults as a business and ethics and everything else that goes into it.
Yeah.
But, when Uber was originally, I think it was probably around their Series B, one of the guys at Benchmark Capital was asked like the total addressable market size. Like, how does he think about Uber and what it could be? And, one of the things he pointed out was Uber at the time, what they were scaling to be was a taxi alternative. But if that's what Uber only aspired to be, he'd made a horrible investment because that's not what the company had the potential to be from a movement of things from here to there. And it was that broader vision and them doing the scaling the core business while at the same time doing the continuous beta on the side. Thinking about experiments like Uber Eats and what could that be? what could those other things lead them to? And the company would not have, you know, reached the heights it has reached now if it wasn't for scaling while also experimenting at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, what's important to do. And if you look, all the companies that have got into that next level, that's what they've done really, really well. You know, that's what an Airbnb has done. You know, that's what, despite some of their struggles lately, you know, if Peloton was only a bike, they wouldn't be getting to that next phase. They have to be thinking about that next. And mm-hmm. that's where I think it becomes really important.
Yeah. Now there is the innovation matrix that you also discuss in your book, Predicting the Turn, and provide many case studies, right, with Spotify, Under Armour. And can you summarize just some of those key elements to innovation?
So, you know, Spotify, I think, is a good example. You know, that's one I talk about in the book, and I've given, used as an example, you know, as I continue to give speeches on it, because they keep evolving and changing, which makes it useful and good, because it means they're actually living up to it. Under Armour, maybe they actually haven't done it as well as I hope. So I'll use them as kind of contrast.
Okay.
So starting with the bad, you know, with Under Armour, the thing I admired so much about them in, you know, call it 2015, 16, was they were making a play around the idea of not everyone can be Nike. Not everyone can be that high performance athlete, but all of us can reach a next level of athletic performance if we have the right data at our fingertips. And the play they made was they went and bought the three leading fitness tracking companies out there to really own that space. And you know what I hope they would be using that for was that next generation of, you know, that every man or woman athlete to be able to reach not the pinnacles of their sport, but the pinnacles of their own potential and that continuing to push themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, because of some, I think, some core business issues that they had, they kind of gave up this amazing foundation that they built with those acquisitions and have even ended up selling off one or two of them along the way as a result. So they're an example of the right strategy, the right, you know, way they were pointing, but they probably didn't do the right investments on their core innovation that made it so their adjacent and transformational innovation could never reach the potential that it was going to.
Yep.
You know, contrast that with Spotify. You know, Spotify has realized that, you know, they could make a choice. They could become the leading streaming music company. And that was going to put them against guys like Pandora as their competition and going against, you know, terrestrial radio, et cetera. Or they could position themselves as an audio company. And that would give them a much broader scope, if you will. Luckily, I think for all of us as consumers, they decided to go after, they were going to be an audio company. And instead of being just a great streaming music, they recognize that audio means a lot of different facets. And that means going into things like podcasts and, you know, owning the vertical integration of what that could mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as they kind of recognize, there is a limitation of their business model if they were making their business only off of streaming other people's music, that meant they had to pay royalties mm-hmm. to other people for doing that.
Yeah.
Versus if they thought about it as a share of ear, you know, the share of the time you spend listening to things, what could they fill that time of, you know, share of ear with that didn't mean them paying royalties to somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
And so that led them down the path of, you know, getting into podcasts in a pretty big way. And now, you know, depending on the consumer, you know, for me, I maybe listen to 5% of my time on Spotify is listening to music.
Mm-hmm.
95% of it is listening to podcasts. And some of those are podcasts that are exclusive to Spotify. And the only reason I even use the Spotify music player is so I can listen to those podcasts. So some really interesting approaches I think they've taken along mm-hmm. the way.
Mm-hmm.
And also a pretty good example of what happens if the founder and visionary stays as a leader for that business and doesn't get distracted with other ventures along the way.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the companies are benefiting from the data that they're collecting. instantaneously in real time across different industries, including in my industry, in the pharma and healthcare. Where now we have siteless clinical trials, we have real world data, right? Digital therapeutics and you name it. And can you describe in more detail the difference between being in an adjacent industry and growing that way versus transformational and being disruptive? Because it may be a little bit subtle. Can you just elaborate on what, you know, how you define, let's say, transformational versus adjacent?
Without doubt. Yeah. You know, so adjacent, the when I was in the world of P&G, we had a thing called 1 degree innovation. And there's this amazing graphic when you go into the general offices in the lobby that shows the 1 degree of innovation that P&G has accomplished over its years. And 1 degree of innovation is adjacent innovation. And what I mean by that is if you go way back to the 1800s, P&G was started as a candle maker. And it was a candle maker because the bend in the Ohio River where Cincinnati sits is where a lot of pigs were offloaded, basically. And pig fat made really good candles. So that's what they started with. The 1 degree was that the other thing you can make with that was soap. And so P&G started making soap and Ivory soap and other products that came because of the candles first. So it went candles, then it went soap. If you start shaving soap, well, that makes laundry detergent. And yeah, that's what led them into brands like Tide, et cetera. And so as you keep going down the line, nearly every product P&G has ever gotten into is an adjacent innovation. It is something that they were in that space and they went into the next space.
Right.
You know, even some of their biggest innovations of the last, call it 2 decades, you know, something like Swiffer, well, they were already in home care, you know, with brands like Mr. Clean. And they had a brand called Pampers on the other side for diapers. Swiffer is basically a diaper on a stick in a lot of different ways when you look at what Swiffer WetJet is, et cetera. So adjacent innovation has always been at their core. Transformational innovation is when you're going after new customers and new categories at the same time. You know, that is making a very big leap instead of going after maybe the same customers in similar categories, if you will. Transformational innovation is a much, much tougher thing to do. You know, that's where a lot of companies die on their swords. Because they're making too big of a leap. Mm-hmm. But when you can do that, it can be really beneficial. You know, I think, you know, for once again, for all their flaws, Tesla is actually one that's a really good example of it, because Elon Musk himself thinks about transformational innovation. You know, a guy that is connected on one side to rockets into space and electric cars on the other, not exactly similar customers or anything together.
Right.
But with Tesla, you know, their move into the solar space and what they've done with the home was kind of an adjacent innovation, but really more transformational. Because yes, they understood battery technology for the Powerwall, but it was a bridge, a transformational innovation of where they were going to go next and how they think about it and what they did with all that spaces.
Yeah.
So it really is, you know, taking you into different industries, different customers, and different things of that nature.
Yeah, yeah. So I would probably define digital therapeutics or software as a medical device, as an individual treatment or a combination treatment, probably as a transformational in my industry, in our industry.
Yeah.
And that's why it has really, you know, attracted me and my attention as I'm starting to learn more about it. But you know, as you mentioned when you described the book, you know, that research and development has really moved from the labs into the public. Now you know there's several ways you can innovate, right? You can acquire a different company, or you can you can invest in innovation. And so I want to ask you about, you know, acquisitions as well, right? Mergers and acquisitions. And
yeah.
Because I know that you've also describe that. And you've been a CEO of Nature's Willow, which has a pain over-the-counter pain relief product, yep. Which I just recently learned about. So are there certain strategies that are more successful, the four categories or steps that you outline in your book, than others? Or how do you determine what's a more viable strategy?
So I'm a big believer of it's going to be very company specific. So there's not a one size fits all of, hey, you should go do this, you should go do that. It's what is your business trying to accomplish and what's going to be the strategy? And I think the best innovation strategy is one that is a matrix by nature. And what I mean by that is you need experimentation. Venture capital itself is about experimentation. It is about doing 20 investments and knowing that 17 of them probably aren't going to work, but the three that do make up for all the others. And corporate innovation doesn't think that way. Corporate innovation is, if we're going to do 20 bets, we'd rather get 20 singles than 17 strikeouts and three home runs. I think what the different thinking needs to be, you need to try a little bit of everything because you don't know which one is going to be the one that leads to successful. So you should be looking at strategic investments and direct investments. You should be looking at investing into, being an LP into other venture funds and creating that deal flow. You should look at partnerships and having individuals, partners, whatever, they're helping you engage with the innovation ecosystem.
Yeah.
You need to be doing all of these things, because none of us are smart enough to know which one of them is going to be the one that works. But Amazon, if you're doing them all, it gives you the chance.
Mm-hmm. And Amazon had a phone faux pas, right? With their phone, right? And that never really made it. But very soon afterwards, they had other products, right? That they released, I think, that you mentioned. And so I think continuing to be an explorer is what I'm, taking away from your suggestions here, which are, I think, so critical, because as the company probably grows large, it measures its innovation in terms of improvement rather than exploration. And that's where the mistake, I think, lies probably. And so that leads me to the question of metrics, of how do you really inspire the quality of innovation, that benefits more people than others, right? Because and you know what comes to mind is Benjamin Franklin, and how he had an anecdote that he told Thomas Jefferson that I wanted to share with you, in which he had said that he, in his young years, when he was in his 20s, he was asked for some comments for a billboard in order to promote one young man, John Thompson, who sold hats. And so Benjamin Franklin, when asked, he told him, why don't you just write, John Thompson makes and sells hats for ready money. And so then he wanted to get other people's opinions. And he asked for others, he asked for one opinion. So they kind of questioned the need for even saying for ready money. If you say sells, that already means for people have to pay for it. So, one by one, that phrase was reduced down to basically just his name and his hat that ended up being on that billboard. And that's when Benjamin Franklin stopped asking people for their opinions and innovation. So my story and question here, Dave, really is, how do the bigger companies, once they grow, they continue not to only innovate, but to do that with quality and with social responsibility? Because that's how those smaller companies try to, they argue that, look, you may be a bigger company, bigger startup company, but we do, we don't charge overhead as much when we do quality work. And
with faster turnaround times and less rounds of editing.
So how do you, measure that quality of that innovation? And
for me, the approach I like is, a friend of mine was senior marketer at Wilson Sports. And he said, when he took that job and got in there, he said, the question I asked for myself, because there was a lot of innovation happening with new brands and new things in that space. He said, if I was starting a brand today that was going to compete in, in this industry, in sporting goods, how would I beat us? you know, what are we doing today that is actually a weakness and we don't even realize it's a weakness? So what would I do today to beat us if I left these halls? And I think that's the place to start, because a lot of times, you know, businesses and the chase for efficiencies and scale and everything else, what you thought had become one of your biggest strengths can actually become one of your biggest weaknesses. And that's what creates the places where somebody else can look and go, I'm going to go nip at their heels here. I'm going to go after this space and start here and see what I can do. Mm-hmm. So that's where I like to have every big company start with. It's, you know, if I was launching something today, where would I try and beat the big company by starting there? And that's what you've seen. You know, a lot of the consumer brands that emerged in the, you know, call it mid 2014-15, that's why they went to direct to consumer, because they said, okay, I can't go beat P&G, Unilever, et cetera, by going to pitch Walmart, trying to get shelf space carved off on these retail shelves, pump out, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of inventory that I hope get paid in net 60 days to me. I'll go bankrupt before I can ever do that. But if I go set up a Shopify site and I start selling direct to consumers and I get paid the day that I mail that product out there, well, that's a lot better. That gives me a lot better chance of going to do it. Mm-hmm. So the big companies looked and said, yeah, we're never going to mess around with that because it's so inefficient. But for the little guys, it was actually the efficiency that allowed them to win and to get started.
I see. So the efficiency, the time efficiency, and just operations. And that example that you provide of Coke really acquiring those processes from Dirty Lemon, for me, was one of the most striking and most illustrative ones from your book. That I don't know if you'd like to just share, you know, what that meant to Dirty Lemon as well as to Coke, and as a result of that transaction or collaboration or partnership.
Yeah. Yeah, so Coke has been, I think, one of those companies that for a long time has been a leader in how they've been thinking about innovation without necessarily getting credit that they deserve for doing it. You know, for, I don't know exactly when it started, but they've had this group that's called the Emerging Brands Group that's been around at least, you know, a decade and a half, if not more than that. And when that group got started, you know, they were really tasked initially with, you know, go find things we can invest in and eventually buy. And they were really focused on brands and thinking about what are adjacent categories that we could go invest in that can expand and give us new spaces and new things to learn, which great area to look at. You know, their R&D team was really focused on the core soft drinks and making the soft drinks better. And this emerging brand gave them a new space. Go figure out the coconut water is taking off, et cetera. One of the shifts that they made a few years ago was they said, we need to be learning not just about new emerging brands, but new emerging ways that consumers are engaging with brands and buying brands. And so Dirty Lemon, their parent company, Dirty Lemon was always meant to be just one of their brands. But what they really were doing was also creating a technology company that was about convenience commerce. And so the way you bought Dirty Lemon was through text messaging. And by sending a message and doing the engagement all there. Mm-hmm. And so when Coca-Cola ultimately bought that, what they were buying was, yes, a brand that was interesting and good products. But more importantly, soft drinks have always been about convenience and impulse. You know, they sell a lot of Coca-Colas at theme parks and in malls and at convenience stores. And a mobile phone is the ultimate inconvenience and that thing that is never more than, you know, 3 feet away from you.
Right.
So what they were buying was a way to think about, instead of retail being something that you went to, retail could be something that was always with you. And what would that impulse look like in a new way? Mm-hmm. And Dirty Lemon was one way for them to do that and figure out that experimentation.
Mm-hmm. So how long lived was that experiment? Are they still... do you know what's, you know, if Coke is still using some of those tactics?
Yeah, you know, once you get sucked up within the halls of a big company, your visibility of what's being used kind of goes away a little bit. So
yeah,
have not heard lately how that's going, but I think it probably served them well in a world where we were all living at home for 2 years, that's for sure.
Right. Speaking of the last 2 years, we've never been at this level of uncertainty, right? In which it's so difficult to predict the next turn. So thinking about your book, your experiences and observations, how has its meaning evolved for you,
Dave? Yeah, you know, when I think about, you know, the world we lived in pre, call it 2020, you know, every company had to predict their own turn, a turn that was taking place in their industry, with their competitors, et cetera. What was fascinating, I think, over the pandemic was it became a turn that we all had to figure out. We had to figure out not just were changes in our industry, but what were changes that were permanently going to be playing out with consumers, and what did that mean? And what were things that, you know, to take the overused term, you know, the new normal that was playing out?
Right.
You know, and one of the ways I like to look at it is I have a lot of investments in the alcohol space and the craft beer space, et cetera. You know, that's an industry that is faced with a lot of new changes that have come about because of the pandemic. You know, on one hand, you know, you've seen a lot of increase in grocery store consumption and what that looks like. You know, on the other hand, you have tap rooms where some day parts have just disappeared. You know, if office workers aren't returning to offices in the way they once did, well, 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock when you went to happy hour at a tap room on your way home from work with, you know, colleagues from work, that's kind of changed and gone away. And will it ever get back to the level it once was? How's that shift? What do you do with it? You had the fact that a lot of bars and restaurants, you know, you could never get to-go alcohol. You could get to-go food, but you couldn't get a cocktail that was made, or you couldn't pick up a six pack to take home. Laws were passed that allowed that to be true now. You know, will we go back to a world where that goes away? Or, you know, here in Cincinnati, and I think you've seen them in a lot of places, these things called DORA emerged, which were these designated outdoor drinking areas, essentially, where you could have beverages that could go restaurant to restaurant. You started in one, you could leave with the drink in hand and go into another, which previously was a violation. But in a world where we wanted to be outside because of everything, it became acceptable. Do we go back to a world where, no, it's you got to put that drink and throw it away when you walk out that door? Don't know. Right. But that's what I think these industries have to change and embrace and figure out. Is there is a turn that has happened in society with consumers, not just with industries, but with society as a whole that we just have to embrace and figure out.
Yeah. I think I heard you mention a prediction that maybe gas stations may go out of business someday because of the electric cars and just right and the convenience stores, really their, you know, their use. So the self-driving cars and auto drive technology is something that I've been always fascinated with, and I've actually followed it. I even did a YouTube video that actually analyzed just the accuracy of this new lane shift technology, and I demonstrated in my test basically that it wasn't 100% accurate by the least bit. I mean, it was about, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of the time it was accurate. Other you know, at other times you're left at basically either your judgment of whether or not to use your hands on the steering wheel. But
yep.
What are some of your predictions as a personal curiosity that I have in how self-driving technology is going to evolve? Because it's here. I know it's here. Most manufacturers have that.
Yeah. So I'm very bullish on it. And, you know, I think with autonomous, I kind of take the, you know, the quote of Bill Gates that I'll butcher exactly how he said it, but he kind of said, you know, we always overestimate how far we'll get in 1 year, and we always underestimate how far we'll get in a decade. And, you know, when we look at what's happened with autonomous and electric, we were all, you know, largely because of a lot of press conferences that Mr. Musk did, I think we were too aggressive on what would be accomplished.
Yeah.
But I look in 10 years from now, I think we're going to be amazed how little, you know, how far it's actually gone. You know, I've got, you know, soon to be 10-year-old twins at home, and I'm not sure if in 6 years they'll actually ever get a driver's license. You know, I think we're getting that close across the board that will take place. And You know, personally, I love it when I think about the ways it could play off. You know, one is I do think we will get to a world where you'll be able to have transportation that is a fit for what you need that transportation to be at this moment. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, you know, here at our house, you know, we have to have two cars because, you know, both my wife and I work. And, you know, my wife's got this Grand Cherokee that, you know, can fit everyone. It's got third row, you know, nice and big. And the kids always complain when they get in my car because I have a small little Ford Escape hybrid. And they're like, oh, mommy's car is so much roomier and nicer to be in. And, you know, we have to have one big car for when they're taking kids, other kids to soccer practice and everything else. But really, my car is meant not really for taking the kids that many places, but for me to go different places. We could see a world with autonomous that the 95% of the time when it's me going to a coffee meeting, I probably don't need something that's very big. So could I call an autonomous vehicle that is specially just for what I need at that moment that doesn't need much space because it's me and my laptop?
Yep.
Versus when it's, okay, I have to go get the kids from soccer practice, the autonomous, you know, maybe it's calling a bigger car that's going to be coming through, you know, through Uber or Lyft or something else. So I think we'll see that evolution that plays up. You know, the second thing is, personally, I love the idea of what's going to change with, you know, lack of a better term, mass transportation and mm-hmm. public transportation.
Yeah.
You know, think about right now that, you know, if I put my kids on the bus, whether that's a school bus or a public transportation bus, I have zero information about them getting from here to there. You know, they're getting on that thing and we'll see what happens. Versus in a world where I would never put them in an Uber car today with a stranger, but in a world tomorrow where I can call an autonomous vehicle that is, yes, they get into that vehicle, the doors only lock and unlock based on the control that maybe I have or whatever it might be. It has a camera inside the car so I can watch and can make watch. Sure they're safe mm-hmm. along the way.
Right.
As a parent, that's a hell of a lot better than putting them on a school bus with somebody I have no idea who that person is and have never met them. Like,
yeah. Well, great example. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by those things that could come about. Yes. And probably the most thing I'm excited about is actually what happens with freight. You know, semi trucks are probably the most dangerous thing we have on our highways right now, but also the most needed thing on our highways. Something that doesn't rely on, did that guy have a 5-hour energy drink to stay a lane and not drift into my lane? I like those moments very much.
Yeah, that's a great juxtaposition there and contrast of great examples. Thank you so much, Dave, for sharing that. I wonder if how you foresee those autonomous cars, there will be a steering wheel or not, because the reason why I ask that is, I had a recurrent dream when I was probably 8 or 10 years old, you know, many years ago, of being in a car with no steering wheel and my family and friends sitting in the back seat, and myself just reading a newspaper while the car was moving, you know. And I remember I have had that dream probably twice or three times, and you know, many years down the road, I'm still very interested in it. And now I just recently got a new car that I had to change. And I realized that I signed up for some features that I didn't really want, because I actually personally, I like the control of the car. I like the control of the speed, or at least have the option of whether or not to turn on that steering control, which I'd like to control myself, you know. But there is, of course, the safety, you know, argument for it. And I completely, you know, understand it. But who knows what the future holds for us. I appreciate those case studies there.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we'll see an evolution. You know, for me, I have a pretty strong belief. I think we will, autonomous only works if everyone's autonomous. If somebody can choose to be a driver or not, it all goes out the window of effectiveness.
Yeah.
So I think on what we'll probably see an evolution is that federal highways, where it can be mandated across state lines, cars will transform into a fully autonomous, and you do not have the option for control at that time. Mm-hmm. But maybe when you get off and you're going on the side streets, your seat swivels back around and you got a steering wheel. I could see those moments happen. Because that's where autonomous is at its best. Autonomous works well and is needed, not when you're driving 10 miles per hour down a city street. Mm-hmm. It's when you're driving 75 miles an hour on a family road trip. You know, that's where autonomous really works at its best, and commutes and everything else. And I think that's where we'll see it first, is that evolution play out.
Mm-hmm. And for me as a consumer or as a driver, Dave, I would really want to make sure that it's 100% safe and 100% accurate in how it interprets the signals, right, at every given second or millisecond from its environment. You know, and that was really the case, the reason why I had done that YouTube video, to demonstrate that it's not at 100% accurate, at least right now, although it's here.
Exactly. Well, and that's why it's got to get to a world where that's good enough. You know, we got on an airplane and we don't realize that pilot's not flying us the whole time. And it's okay, because at that time, if they go 50 feet left or right, it's no big deal.
Right.
Yeah. So what's that equivalent where we get there? So we'll see. But I think it's going to be exciting, and we're going to look back a decade and realize it went a lot further than we expected.
Yes, absolutely. Just to quickly, I would be remiss if I were not to ask you for your opinion or your stance on the social responsibility of technology, you know, of the role that it may compromise or it may overextend, which has been somewhat in the news in the recent years, the privacy of all that data. I know that you're providing a very innovative and a very promising look for in the book. And, you know, I'm of the same opinion, but nevertheless, what is your stance, or is there something that you'd like to see more in terms of regulating this technology and the access?
I mean, for me, I just take a very simplistic, I think, you know, technology can always be used badly, you know, and as good as it can be is as bad as it can be. And human history has shown the negative sides multiple times of innovation and technology going the wrong way and being used in the wrong way. It's our job as leaders to lead and to make sure that we're practicing, you know, white hat, not black hat tactics, and everything we do being in the interest, the best interest, not the worst interest. So I take a very simplistic view on it.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. Yeah, thank you for that. I think it needed to be said, and I think that's very well put there. So thank you very much, Dave. I've really enjoyed having this opportunity to talk to you today. You have helped so many businesses grow and scale and be innovative. I just have to ask you what you feel that your best accomplishment is so far in your career and life.
Yeah, you know, it's I go back and take kind of a simplistic view for that of, you know, for me, that is, you know, being a good father, being a good husband, and doing that. So that's the ultimate thing, that we work to have a good life. And, you know, for me, the accomplishment of anything I've done professionally is for that flip side. And that's, for me, that's the greatest accomplishment.
Thank you very much. That's very commendable and very honorable. And I think it's very fitting for all the different values that, you know, I talk a lot about, you know, the culture as well as the performance, sportsmanship, and the scientific method that I combine at All Out Coach. So I really appreciate your perspective there. How are you stretching yourself and lifting others now? Is there a next book that we can expect, or where can those listeners contact you, Dave?
My publisher keeps pushing me that I need to take the continuous beta concept and turn that into books. So we'll see if that ends up happening here across the board. But you know, I can always be reached all of the social channels, you know, pretty much all of them. I've got Dave Knox as the thing to use to reach out to me on most of those, or just dave@predictingtheturn.com as well. So would love to engage with anybody that wants to learn more. I'm spending a lot of my time kind of advising companies as they think about their own journeys. So always open to conversations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, hey, Dave.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure having the conversation, and thank you again.
Thank you.